Most stories do not start with a journalist. They start with people noticing when a river runs dry, asking why a school is changing, discovering something new next door. Curiosity is human. Your right to keep asking questions is at the heart of NPR's mission, and we are not going anywhere.
As Comic-Con descends on San Diego once more, we're revisiting an episode we recorded mostly inside the convention center last year, talking with fans waiting in line for panels and signings, and picking the brains of authors and experts about romanticy. We heard from a lot of listeners who loved this episode, and it was probably the most fun Anthony and I have had recording the podcast. And it was also the first time I'd ever said lady porn into a microphone. Without further ado, here's the story of how a once-dismissed literary genre turned the publishing industry upside down to the tune of more than $600 million a year and rapidly on the rise. Romanticy is the blend of romance and fantasy, and it is a bona fide literary and social media sensation.
Today, I'm going to give you the ultimate romanticy reading guide.
Five spicy fantasy romance series that are going to keep you up reading all night long.
The Flame and Thorn series is slept on.
I'm not okay. I just finished this book in one day.
Print book sales in the United States have been on the decline, but between 2023 and 2024, they saw a modest bump, thanks almost entirely to romanticy. You've probably heard of A Court of Thorns and Roses by Sarah J. Maas or Fourth Wing by Rebecca Yarros. Both of them and their sequels were top 10 bestsellers in 2024. Last year, romanticy book sales increased by 33%, and people are talking about it on social media. Take BookTok, for example. It's a hashtag on TikTok where users post about books, many of them romanticy. And people are using BookTok a lot, like 370 billion views in recent years.
Book two is utter perfection.
I read six fantasy romance books in May. Let me tell you my thoughts.
Our main character's in love with this prince, but we don't know if we like him.
I think about Throne of Glass at least once a day. This book is killing me.
It's launched authors' careers and fostered a booming new fandom, one that descended on San Diego Comic-Con 2025. I was there, along with my producer, Anthony, and KPBS's Elaine Alfaro, our assistant for the day. We saw the phenomenon firsthand. And even after all our research into how big romanticy has become, we were not prepared for the scale of the sensation.
Okay, so we just got to the Culture of Romanticy panel, and we went to look at the line, and it...
The line is extremely long.
How can we describe how long this line is? It's like...
It won't stop.
It's a football field long.
Yeah.
It really is.
The plus side of these long romanticy lines for author panels and signings is that we had plenty of time to talk to fans, and we learned that there's way more to romanticy than we thought. This genre gets a lot of ridicule, and I get it from both sides. Here's a little story about me. This is not something I talk about much, but years ago, in my 20s, before I had really published anything as a writer, I stumbled upon fan fiction. There was a lot of fanfic back then, right around the time Twilight came out. And as a reader, I was hooked. Sometimes finishing a long book or series feels like a small death, something akin to grief. You've spent so much time with these characters. And these other outlets, like fanfic, give readers a chance to dwell in those worlds a little more. Eventually, I started writing my own fanfiction. And having a community of readers give me instant feedback made me feel valid and capable as a writer. It proved to me that I could start and finish a story, a little morsel of strength I still call on most days. And really, what it taught me was that it was okay to write love stories, even if a story wasn't exactly romance first. I wasn't in it for the smut. I was drawn to the way fanfic let relationships take center stage. Back then, it kind of felt like love stories of any kind weren't taken seriously in literature. With romantasy, there's clearly a surge of love stories in popular books today, but there's still an element of doubt and skepticism about these kinds of stories. I think that's why I've been reluctant to talk about my love story-infused fanfiction origins, an unwarranted worry that people might take me less seriously as an artist. Even with this background, I still had some pretty strong preconceived notions about these romantasy books. Maybe you have some too.
What do you think are some misconceptions about romantasy?
That it's just porn for women, because it's not. Out of a 500-page book, there might be 15 pages of spice.
Yes, there is some spice, but that's not like the number one reason that a lot of people read and love these books.
These stories pack so much into them. It's not just action scene, action, action, or smut, smut, smut.
That it's for women only, and it's lesser than fantasy. I hear that a lot when people are talking about fantasy versus romantasy, and it is just taking fantasy even further.
So there's more to it than just being not smut.
You have to balance so many different elements to tell a romantasy story effectively, and these authors are nailing it.
I've read a lot of like strict classic fantasy that is not as good as a lot of modern romance. So I think people need to kind of just be more open-minded towards that.
They aren't afraid of emotional stakes rather than big action plots.
There's that misconception of romantasy isn't real fantasy. It has dragons, but because there's kissing in it, it's no longer fantasy. It's like you don't want to accept that there's action and kissing in the same world. Like, I'm sorry, action heroes still get horny.
On this episode, we'll hear from authors, fans, and even a real professor of romantasy about the history of the genre, why it's blowing up right now, and how it's getting thousands of people back into reading. This is a deep dive that changed our minds about romantasy, a genre that's been derided in its many forms over decades, a genre that reflects our real world, often giving women power and agency they don't always feel in our current reality, and it's changing its readers' lives. Romantasy might surprise you. From KPBS Public Media, this is The Finest, a podcast about the people, art, and movements redefining culture in San Diego. I'm Julia Dixon Evans.
Most stories do not start with a journalist. They start with people noticing when a river runs dry, asking why a school is changing, discovering something new next door. Curiosity is human. Your right to keep asking questions is at the heart of NPR's mission, and we are not going anywhere.
Miraculously, we were the last people admitted into that packed Culture of Romantasy panel. Inside, eight authors talked about how they incorporate their own culture into their romantasy stories. There was Persian mythology, Korean folklore, Chinese drama. They spoke of stories that open new worlds and inspire, with very little talk of spice.
Books are mirrors, meaning they should reflect the diversity of the world that we live in. And they're also bridges, because that's the only way we get rid of the other.
I want readers to feel like my main characters who come out of situations that you may have gone through and feel empowered and loved and maybe even moved to tears.
And the takeaway should be anyone could be the hero and heroine.
After the panel, hundreds of Romantasy fans made their way to the sunny Sales Pavilion, a slightly quieter Comic-Con area with massive windows and lots of tables for authors and artists to sign autographs and take selfies. We stood out by the signing tables for hours that day, talking to Romantasy superfans. One of the first we talked to was Autumn.
Literally, I have a 10-pound bag of books and every single one is Romantasy.
She's cosplaying as Hel, a half-demon, half-angel, Norse mythology-inspired character from Danielle L. Jensen's Romantasy hit, The Curse Carved in Bone. And she gets a lot out of her single most beloved genre.
You get to learn a lot about yourself and your own personal journey by going on journeys with other main characters, whether it be men or women, overthrowing corrupt governments and kingdoms and learning about trauma and healing from growing up in oppressive families and sibling rivalries. So it's really my jam.
And Autumn, like many Romantasy fans we spoke with, argues that there's more to Romantasy than the love stories. But those love stories themselves have been life-changing for her.
Definitely reading the books made me reevaluate what I was accepting when I was dating. It made me realize that I was accepting less than what I deserved. And so I learned that, and I started really kind of politely demanding more. And I have a very loving and caring partner now, and he's great.
And that's more like the characters in these books. Like, they're more attentive.
Yeah, and proactive about, you know, making things happen and being very attentive to the needs of their partner. And you're like, oh, what? Like, oh, you're injured. Let me, you know, patch up your bleeding arm.
One of the many critiques of Romantasy books is that they portray unattainable, flawless love interests. But they also model what to avoid. Is it okay to have high expectations of a lover? Maybe. But is it okay to know what a villain is like? Definitely. And Autumn's new real-life boyfriend is an everyday hero in her eyes.
So I'm wearing a different costume tomorrow, and I started sewing on it Friday. So I was just sewing through the weekend, and then on Monday, he realized that I was sewing through dinner. And so I'm just at my sewing machine, just going. Don't realize what time it is. And he comes in, taps me on the shoulder, and just has dinner. Like, here, eat.
Let's step away from Comic-Con for a moment and look at the bigger picture. Romantasy as a genre is new, but stories like those that changed how Autumn views relationships are not.
What is the historical function of this genre? This is a genre that historically was created by women and was created by women for women to fulfill their romantic and often sexual fantasies and desires.
This is our Romantasy expert.
My name is Netta Baker, and I'm an advanced instructor in the English department at Virginia Tech. And I teach rhetoric and writing and popular romance and Romantasy in particular.
She says the Romantasy label is relatively new.
That becoming this really widely used term doesn't start to happen until you really accelerate later in 2019, 2020. And that is a predominantly female-born audience consuming books about essentially changing a world gone wrong and finding healthy, heterosexual, if they are straight, relationships with men as well.
Netta echoes a lot of what we heard from fans.
It can model the idea that pursuing a healthy sexual relationship And a lot of times, women who are really invested in those books are more invested in like the world and the relationship and love story as ultimate goal of overcoming things necessarily than they are in the sexual content, although they frequently enjoy the sex in those books as well.
But we wanted to know the history. Annetta says the roots of romantasy go back much further than the pandemic era. And skepticism about romance literature is basically as old as the genre itself.
This idea that romance trivializes is not new. We had concerns about, particularly women, reading about romantic relationships all the way back when you have like the 18th century and the Anne Radcliffe novels were thought to be sensational and would stir improper passions in young women, right?
And the target of the derision has shifted. In the last century, it was the Harlequins, a book publisher that churned out lots of cheap paperbacks, which, Netta says, give us
the idea of the romance being, you know, a dime a dozen, and they all have these very sort of canned plots, and they have Fabio on the cover, but you don't really see heavy, we now have realized this sells, and we're going to really push it until you enter the 2000s. You start having paranormal romance show up very, very frequently, and Twilight sort of kicks off. Well, now the adults, they also want their sort of urban fantasy romance. And then you finally see, we want whole high fantasy worlds, lots and lots of world building, and heavy romance when we get ACOTAR showing up.
ACOTAR is A Court of Thorns and Roses. That series and Fourth Wing are clearly the titans of romantasy. But there was something between Twilight and those two that pushed the boundaries of the romance scenes in particular.
50 Shades of Grey is the first time the public realized erotic romance is a thing. It's very different from erotica, but 50 Shades probably opened up publishers to acknowledging that we could include even more explicit content than we do.
Okay, so erotica, erotic romance, quote, lady porn. Now is probably a good time to understand and distinguish these terms. Because, according to Netta, there are major and very important differences between them.
That's the other thing that I'll see with book talk is people want to criticize it for women basically talking about porn and we're okaying it. I always want to go into my entire lecture about like how porn actually has a very specific definition and this is not it. Romance isn't even erotica. Erotic romance isn't even erotica. Most romances are not even erotic romance. Erotica does not have a focus on a romantic relationship. Erotic romance still requires that there be a heavy focus on the development and like interpersonal growth of a romantic relationship between two characters. It just has very explicit sexual content throughout. And for differences between erotica and pornography, I always go to Gloria Steinem, who said that one, erotica centralizes female pleasure and desire. Pornography is usually objectifying women for the most part. And she also argued that the similarities between pornography and erotica were as close as the similarities between rape and love. And so every time I see people referring to romance as lady porn, not remotely close to what you're describing. And it's a very interesting cultural construct to me that we're very confident saying anything that depicts sexual content is pornography.
Some people lump all romance books that depict sex into the pornography category. That's frustrating to a lot of readers, like Julia, an oceanographer and romantasy fan we met at Comic-Con.
I think the worst one is when you have men tell you that you're reading smut. And that's really hard because if they're watching something like Game of Thrones, I think that has far more scenes that have like a lot of sexual like promiscuity and all this other stuff versus like her books will have like a couple of pages, you know? And if you went to the movies and you saw that, you'd think it was entirely normal for a movie. But because it's something that women like and it's really targeted towards us, it feels like they haven't looked at it, they haven't read it. They read a paragraph and suddenly it's like this, you know, taboo smut thing that we're reading, but I don't think it's that at all. And I think a lot of the best romanticy books, a lot of those scenes are really well earned, and a lot of the development between the characters is built up before it's hit that point of sexual tension.
We wanted to better understand where society's suspicion of romance and romanticy really comes from.
This genre itself is inherently sex positive, and it's inherently subversive. And I would argue that's why it has received as much sort of conventional accepted wisdom flack for 70-some years. Because it's telling women it is totally fine if you want to fantasize about a love that is seems impossible to actually achieve, right? And the idea of women having that level of comfort and confidence in their sexuality and their willingness to talk about it through those books, I think is incredibly threatening to our culture, especially given its tendencies to swing back towards puritanical kind of views of women's sexuality over and over again.
It's no coincidence that romance is breaking out like never before in the social media age.
But with book talk, it gave women who were very used to being shamed for reading romance an opportunity to find that there are millions of them that love to read romance and talk about romance. And so it gave community sort of power and confidence behind something that before they loved, but they were frequently judged for.
Let's go back to the fans in the Comic-Con lines.
Book talk, Bookstagram, one person posts about it and then five more people see it and post about it. And it just, it spreads like wildfire, and then it's got a panel at Comic-Con.
Readers love each other, but the possibilities of things like social media allow people to connect in new ways, in the best possible light.
Women started reading more, and with TikTok and like Instagram, we're sharing more. Like when I was younger, I didn't know what to read, so it was hard to find something. And now I'm constantly reading fun things, so I never get into a book slump.
Most stories do not start with a journalist. They start with people noticing when a river runs dry, asking why a school is changing, discovering something new next door. Curiosity is human. Your right to keep asking questions is at the heart of NPR's mission, and we are not going anywhere.
Romanticy is in an interesting position now. It's huge. It's lucrative. Romanticy novel sales reached over $600 million in 2024. But it's still not really seen as genuine art or literature or anything serious. There's certainly a history of this kind of thing when it comes to predominantly female fandoms. People even scoffed at the Beatles back when they were met by screaming girls on their first trip to the U.S.
You know, fantasy is getting picked up by women authors way more than it ever was for, you know, big deals. We're seeing massive deals for quote-unquote romanticy.
This is Adeline Grace, one of romanticy's hottest authors.
So we are gaining a lot of ground, but there still is such a stigma around romanticy. I've had conversations with my publisher, especially for my new series, my adult one, that do we call this romanticy?
Adeline is the author of Belladonna, a supernatural romantic mystery, and she lives right here in San Diego. We talked to her after one of the Comic-Con romanticy panels, but she's a little wary of that term, romanticy.
I write fantasy, and the fantasy I write has romance in it, just like, you know, a lot of books by male authors. Now that women have infiltrated the category, it's like, oh, we have to create this whole new word for what we're doing. And it's the exact same thing that people have been doing forever. My actual dream is that we're just acknowledged for writing fantasy and that we get equal footing in that space. Like I can go sit on a panel, not talking necessarily about romanticy, but talking about fantasy with Brandon Sanderson. Like I want to be on the same table as Brandon Sanderson, you know? There's not that dividing factor. We're not writing anything different. It's just all fantasy.
This is another major point about why romanticy is blowing up now, the often overlooked fantasy element of the equation. Yes, 2019 and 2020 were the years that TikTok took off, which gave rise to BookTok. But they were also the years the world started to feel even more precarious.
A lot of things started happening really quickly. So, you know, politically, both the pandemic and everything that's going on, it kind of felt like we're in the bad part of the fantasy of the romance novel. And we're kind of trying to wait for that next point where it's the good part again, and we're going to make it to the end.
I think I just love transporting into like a different world. And especially when the world right now is such a negative and dark place.
I read a lot of these romantic books where there are governments that maybe need to pipe down a little bit.
Books are a social commentary of the time, and a lot of these romantic books are, you know, overthrowing oppressive governments or, you know, fighting against big bad evil. But it does, I think it does link up into common day stuff, and it's like a way for people to read these books and see a positive outcome in the future.
Netta, the romanticy scholar, agrees that real-world events have a lot to do with the romanticy explosion.
But the through line is, in my eyes, reflecting an anxiety that I think is not unwarranted about women's place in the world right now and wanting to have more power and control over it. And most of those narratives give them that to a significant degree. Let's give you a world where, yes, it could be awful. It could be even worse than this. But ultimately, you will be able to fix it. These characters will fix it. It will right itself. And hopefully there's also dragons.
Netta says that an escapist approach to reading romanticy is totally fine.
But you can also deeply read into what is happening within those books, what it might suggest or what it might imply to readers about current power structures or critiques on what heroism and morality might mean, on what relationship dynamics can or should look like, or how to resolve certain interpersonal conflicts in relationships.
Netta, after all, teaches a real college course on these books. Students read and discuss romanticy for a grade, for credits, and these conversations are as intelligent and enlightening as anything else you'd find in a college lit class.
One of the more interesting ones, we read the first adult werewolf male main character as opposed to vampire, which was A Hunger Like No Other by Cressley Cole in 2006. And students were really interested in talking about ideas of being biracial, interracial marriage, and xenophobia. One of the beautiful things about working with popular fiction, as opposed to things that are, you know, 50 or more years old, is you can grasp it so quickly because there's not a language barrier or even a major cultural barrier to you understanding maybe what the author was drawing on.
So romanticy is tackling big issues, and beyond the books themselves, it's doing something bigger. It's working against what seems like an irreversible trend. Over the last decade, reading scores in schools have dropped, and in 2022, a U.S. Census survey found that less than half of adults reported having read even one book in the past year.
From a bookseller perspective, I am seeing a lot of people find reading and rediscover reading through reading romanticy right now.
A Court of Thorns and Roses was my gateway back into reading. As a kid, I was reading fantasy for fun, and that was my escape. And then I think as I got older, I was like, oh, I have to read the classics. I have to read the more serious stuff. And then romanticy kind of opened that door again of like, hey, you can actually get that escapism that you loved from reading when you were a kid. It's still there.
When I had my son, who's 12 now, I had almost completely stopped reading because I was just so busy. And one day I picked up Fourth Wing and I was like, oh, that's right. I love reading and I love doing this. And then I began telling everyone I know, like, you need to read this book and this is so good. And I've been alone, been able to get like 5 or 6 more people to start reading again. And it's amazing because reading does so much for us and we learn so much and it opens your mind.
There's a huge difference between the days that I spend reading versus the days that I spend scrolling on my phone. I'm calmer. I'm more like, it feels like I'm like disciplining myself. It's wonderful. I much prefer to read.
Reading is fun again. That's a win in and of itself. Not only is reading good for your brain, a well-established scientific fact, reading also boosts empathy. It's an antidote to the kind of bad part of the fantasy novel world we might find ourselves in now.
Putting yourself in the mind and shoes of someone else, it stretches your muscle to be empathetic. It forces you to consider the thoughts and experiences of others. And even if you're doing it just in a pretend setting, it will change your ability to do that as a person in real life.
We talked about empathy with Kaylee Smith, another big-time romanticy author from San Diego. Kaylee's wildly successful debut, Phantasma, came out last year.
Yeah, I empathy is always my first answer in that. I think the more we can get people reading and thinking, and I think whilst we move into an age where generative AI is taking over and things like that, it's really nice to have these spaces that feel so very human, because machines just cannot put a soul into a book like a real human being is. And I think it's so important now more than ever to sort of have that sort of community in the arts, especially.
When you meet fans, are there any like interactions that stand out or like themes about like when people talk to you about what your work meant to them?
Yeah, actually, Phantasma has a very big like mental health aspect in it. And I mean, like, I almost cry every time because I have so many fans who come and it's like, I've never gotten to see this like so accurately represented. Like, they didn't have a lot of media about the OCD part of the book. And it's like so special and touching to think that I might have had any sort of like little part of their life or finding themselves, whatnot. Yeah, I've gotten letters from readers and say that they've left like abusive partners even after they've like read my books, which is like so incredibly touching. So yeah, like fan interactions are the best part of the job. I always say that.
Adeline Grace has had similar experiences.
Belladonna has a component of mourning and how people mourn and how they process death. And it was something very personal to me because as I was drafting the book, I experienced 4 different deaths in my family or close friends during that time. And I feel like the book often finds people when they need it. So those interactions are very special.
Romanticy ticks a lot of boxes for things that society, for lack of a better term, hates on. For one, its fandom is female-dominated. But just like the Beatles and even things like skincare, which became universally loved once everyone realized they were great, it's not hard to imagine men getting into romanticy. We even met some pioneering male romanticy fans.
World building and things that is involved in a lot of these that really set them apart from the typical romance novels that people think about.
The character building in most of the books that we've come across is great, and it just dives you into that world and you get to forget about everything else in the world.
Most of my current friends, I'd say, we meet like and talk over like books that we're reading, and it's like have our little book clubs and we trade and talk about it, and it's really fun.
The other thing working against romanticy is that it's just new. It's boundary pushing, just like fan fiction was, which was an essential breeding ground for much of the romanticy we have today.
I used to write Twilight fan fiction.
Kaylee Smith is one of many authors who got their start writing fanfic, like I did. In my case, fan fiction was a short phase. For years, I felt a kind of shame about it, but it was undoubtedly formative, both as a reader and a fiction writer. I may not have talked about it much, but so many of the people we spoke to at Comic-Con gladly and willingly celebrate writing stories about love. So is the buzz, what's special about fanfic and the romance and romanticy genres, about the romance? Not really. For me, it was anchored in stories that are so deeply human. Love and its epic highs and lows is one of the most universal situations we'll ever find ourselves in.
It goes beyond just magic and just romance and stuff like that. I think a lot of what I connect with in these books is just really real and raw human emotion. There's a lot of internal struggle and insecurities that I think a lot of people resonate with in society. And I think that that can be very impactful. So, yeah.
It's kind of taught me that, like, one, the first person that you fall in love with does not need to be the end all of end all. That's what A Court of Thorns and Roses taught me. And I think also that, like, love doesn't have to happen instantly. It can grow and flourish over a long period of time, and that it creeps up on you.
I really like reading about, like, women having adventures, going out into the world and making it what they want it to be. Maybe it's a story about someone who they're living a life that isn't what they want, but they go out and change it. And it's kind of like, they can be inspiring, and it can also just be escapism and kind of gives you hope for, maybe it doesn't have to be anything dramatic, but hope for something a little different in the future.
Yeah. Beautiful stories, vivid worlds, new ways of seeing love and power, and the kind of reading that boosts empathy and fires up your imagination. What's there to be ashamed of?
Anything that's going to get people to realize that stories are an art form in and of themselves. And love stories are an art form. They're a beautiful one that we've always loved through fairy tales. And now our modern fairy tales have more world building and more richness to them to immerse ourselves in. And I would be blissfully happy if readers were just obsessed with that genre for the rest of their lives. I'm like, that's going to be a happy life with that sort of art in it.
Special thanks to Netta Baker, Adeline Grace, Kaylee Smith, and all the fans we talked to in the Comic-Con lines. And thank you to Jenny Marchisotto from Mysterious Galaxy Bookstore for her help with this episode. Next week, we're talking about today's local music scene and the biggest band to ever come out of San Diego.
There was kind of like a Blink-182-shaped hole in pop culture at that time that they just came at the right place, right time, and filled.
Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It really helps new listeners discover the show. And best of all, if you can think of anyone in your life that might like The Finest, please share it with them. I'm your host, Julia Dixon Evans. Our producer, lead writer, and composer is Anthony Wallace. Our engineer is Ben Redlosk, and our editor is Chrissy Nguyen.
Each story you hear on Planet Money starts with a question. What happens if we refund tariffs? Why are groceries so expensive? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious, because the forces shaping our world can be hard to see. Follow NPR's Planet Money wherever you get your podcasts and start seeing how the economy really works.